Good day, everybody, or good evening, whatever time of day you're listening to this to. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
And I'm his brother, Doug. No, just... Actually, I'm Scotty Hertz of the CFRU news team. And Adam, I was going to ask, we obviously survived the rapture. I didn't realize that was supposed to be part of the eclipse and everything, but I was very intrigued. The fact that after the lights went out and came back on, I mean, the celestial lights went off and came back on, that we were still standing. So that was a good feeling.
I even went outside to make it easy. I just,
just a pair of pants lying on the lawn right here, go.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because I did see somebody on Twitter, like, after, or, you know, during the eclipse, like, saying, go outside right now and do this, and they had a picture of, like, just, like, with their laundry on the lawn, just to, to freak out the neighborhood.
And we never saw him again. Yeah. Thank God.
Well, that would be if you're, like, going, like, full Joaquin Phoenix with that, and just, you know, for a year, you're going to pretend you were raptured up, and... I mean, I'm not saying don't do it, but on the other hand, I think you're now waiting till 21-something for the next eclipse.
Oh, next rapture, whenever it's predicted, which is probably, like, in a couple of weeks, I'm going
to... Oh, yeah, so the next one's always around the corner.
It's always
a
couple weeks or a month, right?
Absolutely.
Going to be ready.
I'm always ready. My go bag's always ready. Anyway, Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians, which this week will be Kit Andres from the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change. And they are going to tell us about the challenges facing migrant workers in Canada and how we can all make sure to work and improve the lives of those people, whether they are our farm workers, whether they are our care workers, whether they are staffing the en routes we drive through on the weekend on our way to our relative's place. That may be a little insight into your life, into my life, but that's going to be in the bottom half of the hour. Before that, we're going to talk about a few news items from the last week, including the Canadian defense spending announcement on Monday. There was an announcement, as I said, on that subject, but is it doing everything it needs to do, especially in the NATO department? We're going to talk about that. But first, it is back to Gaza, where... there is a lot of rumbling about ceasefires, and there's a lot of rumbling about Biden finally putting his foot down about Netanyahu and the Israeli Defense Forces and the conditions in Gaza. It seems like, unfortunately, this is kind of what it took, the death of seven World Central Kitchen workers who were killed in a drone attack from the IDF on April 1st. Unfortunately, seemed to take this event, not the 33,000 people who have been killed in Gaza, but these seven. Biden got on the phone, President Joe Biden got on the phone with Netanyahu. Some discreet threats seem to have been made about withholding aid to Israel, whether that was in the form of future weapons or attaching conditions to future weapon sales. No one can really say. But in the last few days, about 400 aid trucks have been going into Gaza every day, whereas the daily average just in February was about 98 trucks a day. So whatever Biden said seemed to work. And it seems that not making aid conditional or not making future military aid conditional on humanitarian aid being sent to Gaza seems to have been a mistake, because it seems like one threat and humanitarian aid doth start flowing.
Yeah, and considering how many threats there had been.
Yeah.
There's just this endless... You know, you really need to watch what you're doing. You need to do something. And it was all ignored. It was just effectively ignored. Mm-hmm. And as you said, I think this is part of what it took. There's also negotiations going on. I think it's in Cairo currently to try and bring this to a stop, ceasefire some degree. Although breaking news on Wednesday, and this may put things in jeopardy a bit. One of the top Hamas leaders, Haniyeh's kids, 3 sons and 4 grandkids were killed in an airstrike as they were celebrating Eid in a refugee camp. Now, I'm not sure whether, since this is an evolving story, as to whether it was targeted or as to whether this is just the usual, let's just bomb everyone, which is what seems to be happening, even though they keep insisting, oh, was it a regrettable incident, as they said with the aid workers, unintentional incident. Like, this is just reductivist crap at this point. No yeah. one believes you. No one believes that you're not targeting certain people for reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And also, very interesting story that dropped late last week that may kind of explain or indicates that the collateral damage is intentional was the use, 2 reports out of 2 different Israeli media outlets reporting that the Israeli government is using AI to target identifiable targets from a kill list.
Mm-hmm.
Damn the collateral damage, damn the civilian deaths. They don't seem to care. In fact, there's supposedly alleged statistical numbers and levels of death that are acceptable. It's a range from 5 to 100. If it's a top dog, it doesn't matter how many people are killed, as long as they can get that person. Now, in Haniyeh's case, he lives in Doha. He's in exile. So he's not even, if they wanted to get this guy, they would have to bomb him in Doha. And there's no chance of, well, I mean, I suppose there's a chance of that. Yeah. Send the Mossad after him or something. But what did those grandkids do? And even the sons, we don't know what they're, we know no idea what.
Right. Yeah.
So, but specifically the grandkids. So it's like, but that's, it's acceptable to, this is acceptable to the Israeli government.
Yeah.
And it's not acceptable to, I'm going to say most of the world, but.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that's, what the what the blowback is going to be from this, but I suspect it's going to be fairly huge.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Haniyeh's, you know, in exile, so he's not even in Gaza, so, you know, what is killing his family about? And, you know, there is no detail about whether or not his sons are involved in the organization or what you mean. But, you know, 33,360 people killed, another 94,000, almost 95,000 wounded. The Gaza Health Ministry says that's two-thirds of those numbers are women and children. And you got to think, too, you know, there's no way that 33,360 of the casualties are all Hamas fighters. I think that's probably more people than there are in Hamas, probably globally. But, you know, also when you think about, you know, half of Gaza is children under the age of 18. Yeah, that, you know, that's at least, well, half of 33,000, so 16, 17,000. That's probably kids under 18 for sure. As for, you know, striking outside a country, we're kind of seeing this. There was an Israeli assault on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. 2 generals were killed, 5 high-ranking five other high-ranking military officials. And of course, now this is opening up front. Now, you know, they're wondering if Iran's going to be attacking Israel, and if Iran attacks Israel, Netanyahu said, yeah, we'll attack, you know, Iran if it comes from inside. If the attack comes from inside Iran, we'll certainly attack inside Iran. Now we're talking about an entirely different thing. And of course, as you mentioned, Ramadan is completed with the celebrations of Eid. So if, you know, any agitators of the Muslim persuasion are perhaps waiting for the end of the holy month to start some stuff, the door is wide open. And I mean, we keep hoping that it can't get any worse, but it can always get worse.
Yeah, Netanyahu's survival depends on this continuing.
Right.
And some of it is probably just antagonizing people to keep it going.
Yep.
So now the narrative changes, like, oh, Iran is a threat. And Iran is always looming in the background, but that's not what this is or was about. Although when you attack an embassy, it's actually the territory of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So this is significant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to say. You could speculate and say, well, they did this to agitate some more. And we know that also in southern Lebanon, Hezbollah has been attacking from the north. So we're, unless something comes of these talks, we're minutes away from this blowing up even further to a regional conflict. But as I said, Netanyahu's treating it as a distraction. If when this ends, the government is probably going to fall. Well, you know, in Israeli politics, it's how it works. It's like it's all coalitions and whatnot. It will end. The wartime government will collapse or fold, and then it'll be the next thing. So,
well, there's already a danger of collapse because, like, everybody's saying it to Netanyahu, like, do not launch an attack on Rafah. Do not do it. And he said, like, oh yeah, no, the date is set. I guess, you know, he's, you know, written it down in his diary or something. And then the defense minister comes out and said, like, I don't know anything about a date. And then you get this guy, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's, you know, one of the members of the far right party. He's presently the national security minister of Israel. And he says, hey, guys, if we're not, like, blowing Rafah off the face of the earth, we're pulling our support from the government. And so what kind of game is Netanyahu playing here? Is like, is there a date? Is there a date, wink, where the Rafah invasion begins? And how long can he keep up that ruse? You know, especially as there doesn't seem to be any plan for what's going to happen in Gaza after the war. You have this humanitarian crisis in progress, 1 million people suffering famine. It's not that they can't get the, you know, like, it's not like the waning days of the Soviet Union where people were complaining about how there was only one type of cheese instead of the usual three types of cheeses. There's no cheese. There's no anything in Gaza, which is one of the reasons why World Central Kitchen is there doing the very dangerous work of feeding people. But yeah, you know, there's famine. Like, that's no joke. And people look at this humanitarian or anything, it's like, come on, Netanyahu, be a nice guy. But, you know, I've heard, as I've heard people say, like, people who are experts in, like, foreign relations and military affairs, it's like, making sure humanitarian aid gets to people, that's not a nice to have. That's international law. He is bound by international law to make sure people don't starve to death. And he had to have his arm twisted to make it happen. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, Israel being a nation that has trauma at its roots.
Yeah.
You behave this way. This is the way you behave. I'm not saying it's the way that you should behave, but there's lots of explanations for it, I suppose. But on the face of it, when you see everything that's going on, I mean, there's now something like 1 million people jammed into Rafah.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to wonder whether it's sort of a bluff saying, well, you know, we're ready, we're gonna attack it, hoping that will make movement in other places for things to happen. But it's a bad, bad bluff. And you probably saw some of the footage of the people going back into Khan Yunis there.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing. And that's the plan. Like, there's people going to the remains of their homes. It's not even, there's nothing there in some cases. There's just rubble. Some people are able to get personal effects if they can find them. But that seems to be the intention. Is Hamas in every home, in every building, in every square foot of Khan Yunis? Don't think so. But this, you see the real intention when you see this footage and hear what's coming out of that. And they're pulling, you know, the 33,000 is the official, somewhat official count.
Yeah.
But they're spending the days pulling people out of the rubble, or the remains of people out of the rubble. So it's
unbelievable
that it's allowed to continue.
I mean, it's being allowed to continue, and that's kind of the frightening part. Is now you, not necessarily frightening, but perhaps unfortunate part that you have. We've now crossed 6 months of this. Last weekend, 6 months since the October 7th attack that kicked all this off, and we're finally at a point where we're saying like, isn't this enough? And it's like, well, one would imagine if you had like 10,000 people killed in Gaza, that would have been enough, or 20,000, or 30,000, or 5,000, or 1,200, to make it proportional. But it's been off the charts. It's been way off the charts since pretty much this began. There hasn't been a plan for peace. Any peace that has been achieved has been like under sheer gruntlement. And Biden has shown a complete unwillingness to really stand up for peace. And now he's at that point. And again, it took the death of seven people from World Central Kitchen to sort of make that point. And Jose Andreas, who's the founder of World Central Kitchen, has been really, really great. But it shouldn't have been allowed to get this far. And it shouldn't be like 6 months into this, we're finally saying, I mean, it's like nobody's even really putting their foot down. It's just like, haven't we had enough? Isn't this good enough? And we're still waiting for cooler heads to prevail, and I'm not 100% sure there are cooler heads, at least on the Israeli side, probably the Hamas side too. But
No,
we're just,
it's war crime level at this point.
yeah.
And again, I feel I have to say, I mean, that doesn't excuse or forgive what Hamas did
No, of
on
course not.
October the 7th, because that a lot of that would qualify as war crime as well, probably most of it.
Absolutely.
But
Yeah.
do you match that with a response like this?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah,
Even
one
if it
war
was a
crime
one
doesn't
for
solve
one
another.
response, totally wrong.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see in future years what the fallout from that will be, if any, right? People walk away from
Yeah.
this stuff all the time, so.
True enough. All right, speaking of walk away from stuff, it might almost be seeming like Canada's walking away from its commitment to spend 2% of GDP on internal defense, as all NATO members should. There was, however, an announcement on Monday. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau went to Trenton to talk about $8.1 billion. Sorry, I forgot to turn the page on my notes here. I'm pretty sure it was $8.1 billion, for national defense spending. That includes new AWACS, so essentially, radar stations on planes, potentially new submarines, but also like sensors along Canada's three coastlines and new satellite station in the Arctic. Essentially, we're bulking up for potential strife with Russia around the Arctic Circle. That seems to be where the priority is. But there is that sticking point. This is not getting us to 2% of GDP on national defense. There are grumblings that some of the European allies are a little fed up with Canada's lack of commitment to hitting that benchmark. 2% is supposed to be the floor, not the ceiling, as the saying goes. But I mean, this is a kind of generational problem. No matter the government, whether talking about Chrétien, Martin, Harper, Trudeau, we keep talking about spending more on defense, and then when the time comes, we seem to find a reason not to do that.
And in this case, it might be the government changes
Sure.
and then the math changes. Although I recall Polyev saying that he would increase spending by, cutting like international aid and whatnot. So, which
Well, I
wouldn't be a
mean,
surprise.
no, but that's something you say when you are the conservative leader.
Yeah, exactly. But that's where they'll do it. Well, he probably would, but let's not worry about that for now because it's not happening yet. But what is happening? It's called Our North Strong and Free is the plan. So, as you said, the focus is going to be in the North, and probably wisely so. This it's kind of harkens back to the days of the Dew Line, which was kind of an American project in Canada, but we're going to see, I think, more drones and satellites and modern tech, maybe. It's always a maybe because they'll say these things and then, but it's a long, the spending is a long haul. It's well past what might be the due date or the expiry date of the government, projecting into, I think it was 2030. And then they'll hit their target of 1.76, which doesn't hit NATO's 2% request.
Mm-hmm.
Now, somebody dug up, I think it was CBC, that uncomfortable moment that Trudeau had with Trump when Trump's like, so how much, what are you spending? And Trudeau tried to deflect and started talking about Estonia or something,
mm-hmm.
Who are actually hitting their target, their NATO target, but Estonia has, 1.2 million?
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on that, but it's a much smaller amount of people, but of course, they're right in proximity to the Russian threat. So that's
smaller country.
We're going back to the early days of NATO. NATO mm-hmm. retro. We're a long way from like the Lester Pearson days of NATO, but it's still going to be, there has to be the focus for NATO
mm-hmm.
because the threat is very real.
Mm-hmm. I would argue not just a threat from Russia. I would argue there is also a threat from the United States. It's not impossible that Donald Trump might win the election. And then what happens? You know, if we're depending on, you know, the cordial relationship we have always had with the United States, well, that wasn't really terribly cordial, to get to your point about, you know, Trump and Trudeau relationship. And Trump, of course, is like fiendish about this idea that NATO owes the United States and he's going to collect and...
Mm-hmm.
Although that is like just patently incorrect, and you know, any number of people could correct Donald Trump if he is someone who took correction well. But it behooves us because we are almost quite literally between a rock and a hard place. Russia on the other side of the Arctic Circle, and the United States below us. We should probably assert some independence. But you know, I have this, you know, I was thinking about when we're talking about making this one of the topics this week, you know, this is something that's hounded Trudeau, not all the time, but it's always like there in the background amongst a litany of things that are always waiting for their turn on the front burner. But it was the same for Harper. Like, Harper was always stymied by making decisions about buying new fighter planes or investing in new tech, or and then it goes back to, you know, the Chrétien Martin liberals were for that, and probably to an extent goes back to the Mulroney Campbell Tories and at the end of the Cold War, and you know, what do you do when it's the end of history? So, and then that's on top of, like, and I was thinking about this today, like all this stuff in the 90s and the 2000s about how Canadian forces sucks and their equipment sucks. And, you know, the forces have been a punching bag for a while. And you know, it just made me think of that with the, you know, recruitment numbers are down something like 100 and or not 100, like, but like 16,500 recruits they need. There's like a recruiting deficit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's not even just like a money for like the new toys, it's like people to use the toys we're missing out on too. There's just like a cultural lacking, I guess, when it comes to taking our own security seriously. And like I said, it goes back generations. It's not a Trudeau thing. It's not something to let's say go out on top of the bridge over the Hanlon and wave a flag about.
Yeah.
That may be a very specific reference to,
yeah, absolutely. Honk. Yeah. Drive Adam nuts at home. Yeah, do that. I'm sure you can hear it. But where were we going with that? You were talking about personnel and personnel shortages.
Yeah.
Which has been a problem, but I mean, try and get people to do the job. One of the key things is that there's no talk of the cultural change or the attempts at cultural change in the Canadian military anymore.
Mm.
Operation Honor. Does anyone remember that? Does anyone know what I'm talking about? No. Why? Because it came and went.
Yeah.
It was a failure. Why did it fail? Because of all those top brass that were exposed when they started to do the digging. It's like, he did this, he did this. And it's usually men. He did this. And in the wake of that, I think there's maybe a little bit of that backs of people's minds. It's like, well, why would I join this outfit? If they've made no attempt or a feeble attempt that didn't achieve anything to change,
mm-hmm.
they just kept, I need it on talking about it and talking about it, talking about it, but it's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've talked about this before. It's like, try and get people to do not this. That sounds terrible. Try and get people to do anything. It was like when we were talking about the, I'm going to compare it to the firefighters last week or a couple weeks ago when we were talking about that.
Yeah.
Huge commitment. You have to go training. And then, of course, you have to go around the world potentially and fight. If the focus was a bit more on just playing defense, and I'm not going to use a hockey analogy, but if we were playing defense rather than within the NATO scope of things, because I'm not sure if, well, I know that not everyone agrees with the whole NATO setup necessarily.
Yeah.
But no one could follow you if you wanted to say, look, we want to protect the North. We want to protect our shores and whatnot. Now, that's sounds a bit retro. But if you were trying to encourage people to get involved, they'd be like, yeah, we're going to do this. It'd be more like National Guard, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, believe me, it's not my place at all to make military policy and how it should work. But you can see the faults in it as to why people don't want to get involved, people want to get engaged. But then when it comes to this magic 2% number, and I think this 1.76 may be the highest it's been in a while. Or I'm saying maybe it hasn't happened yet. If they hit it, because I think it's 1.3 now, then it will be the highest. But who was it that said, well, we're not going to be at bench strength. Who was it that was talking? We're not going to be at bench strength until 2032.
Mm-hmm.
That's 8 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the thing. They always just kind of punt this forward, knowing that somebody else will have to deal with it. Like, they're still waiting for F-16s, right? We're still waiting for planes. We're still waiting for...
There's that's always why they're running punting. Old gear.
That's why the
yeah.
snowbirds keep flying around and crashing, because
right. they're
running planes that are older than me.
But there's always this punting, because I think there's like this visceral fear of like alarming the peaceniks with more military spending. I'm not sure there is such a thing as peaceniks anymore. I know a lot of people invested in peace, but I mean, I was just thinking about today, like 24 Sussex. Like, Trudeau didn't move into 24 Sussex. We still don't know what we're going to do with 24 Sussex. Tear it down, fix it. Probably not getting any better just being let to rot there in the national capital region. But I mean, it's kind of a symbol for a lot of what has been foreign government policy, which is like, why put off, why do today what you can put off tomorrow, which is not how that saying goes. But we'll have to leave that there and, well, wrap up this segment of the show, because we have another segment coming up after the break. We are going to talk to Kit Andres from the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change for something completely different. You are listening to Open Source's Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Bob's got a brand new car, yeah, you know it's gonna take him far. All said and done, it's gonna be one hell of a ride.
That was Erin Ross, out of Calgary. Singer, but also she happens to be a community radio host. Shout out to Erin Ross.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that until I did a little bit of the homework. But anyway, the album's called The Wind Will Lead Me Home. And the song was Papa's Got a Brand New Car. And that song is actually all about the Source Mobile. Because it needs this and it needs that and it needs another thing. And
it's still going.
Because I'm never getting a car that's smart. And I don't mean a smart car.
There are a lot of funky features on some of these newer cars that really make you wonder. But we're not here to talk about cars. That's a different show. We're here to talk about migrant workers. And we invited Kit Andres from the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change to talk about that very topic. You probably know about the MWAC because usually when there is a protest or some organizing around the treatment and status of migrant workers in Canada, they are the ones leading it. And Kit is one of those organizers. They are out of the Niagara region. Kit is farm folk themselves. And he is one of the key organizers. They work with farm workers all around Ontario and are trying to get status for those workers, a permanent status, permanent residency. There is a lot of issues when it comes to our migrant farm workers. It is very easy to exploit them. It is not so easy to protect them given the system, and that's where groups like MWAC come in. So there's a lot to talk about with this topic. I was barely able to scratch the surface with Kit, but I think we had a very interesting conversation just the same. So let's hit play on our interview with Kit Andres from the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change. Okay, Kit Andres, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
First, for people who may not be aware of your organization, can you talk a bit about the Migrant Workers Alliance and what you do in the organization?
Absolutely. So Migrant Workers Alliance for Change is a migrant-led membership-based organization, which means our leaders and our members are current and former migrant farm workers, migrant care workers, international students, as well as undocumented kind of frontline healthcare workers. So basically, we are uniting together to build migrant power and to win changes that migrants want to see. And one of our core demands is permanent resident status for all.
Okay. You didn't tell us what you did with the organization.
So I'm one of the organizers. I connect mainly with English-speaking farm workers from the Caribbean. We also have organizers who connect with different sectors, but that's kind of my area.
Okay, perfect. I'm just so eager to get started with the real questions.
Get into it.
You know, in your answer to that, in terms of like who your organization is and who it makes up, what I find interesting is that it really opens up the idea of sort of who is a migrant worker and what a migrant worker does and what they come here to do. And also, as you're saying, you deal specifically with English speaking workers from the Caribbean, where people are coming from as well. So I guess in looking at that, as you know, you and your colleagues are going about your day, like, do you have like a set definition for what is a migrant worker? Like, who are they? You know, as opposed to someone who is immigrating here, I guess where do we draw that line, as it were?
Yeah, for sure. That's a great question. So our working definition of migrant worker is basically any working class person, mainly from the global south, who is in Canada without permanent resident status.
Mm-hmm. And again, just to sort of get to the definition of these things, when we're talking about the global south, where is that line?
So that's basically outside of, you know, the colonizing countries. These are right. Largely countries that have been colonized in many different continents, Central America, South America, the Caribbean, Africa, Asian countries as well. So the global majority of people.
Fair enough.
We're coming here as working class people and largely supporting their families back home and their communities back home.
Mm-hmm. And with these workers, you mentioned that one of the goals of the group is to work towards permanent residency. Is that like a goal of every migrant worker who's coming to Canada, that they're trying to find a path to stay here? Or is this kind of like a, you know, they go and work in Canada for a couple of months and then go back home and do something else the rest of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. So our demand for permanent resident status for everybody is not just about living and working in Canada, because migrant workers already live and work here, right? Mm. The problem is that they don't have equal rights.
Right.
So they come here as second-class citizens, which creates a two-tiered society where some of us have more rights than others, and that is not the basis of a fair society, right, where mm-hmm. some of us have more rights than others. So they're already living and working here. The demand for status for all is a demand for equal rights. Mm-hmm. Some migrants don't want to stay here permanently, bring their families up, you know. Many do.
Mm.
So the demand for permanent status for all is a demand for equal rights and for control over their own lives, being able to make decisions that are best for them and their families instead of politicians and bosses making those decisions for them.
For migrants right now, do they have a path to permanent residency, or are we talking about like creating something? I guess what I'm asking is, are we talking about making the process easier, or are we talking about creating a process?
So we're talking about permanent status on arrival. So as
Okay.
soon as they arrive in the country, and we're also talking about permanent status for undocumented migrants who are already here. So for those who are in the country, either on temporary permits or do who don't have status at all, as well as permanent status for those who will arrive in the future. So currently, that's close to 2 million people in
Wow.
Canada who are already living and working here, paying taxes, volunteering at community organizations, being part of churches, temples, other faith organizations. So this is about creating a fair society where all of us can thrive and kind of lifting the floor for the benefit of everybody here.
I'm curious in your discussions and the work you do, the status, as you described, that migrant workers have in Canada is, I mean, is it fair to say that's exploitation? Is that a too big of a word to throw around when we're talking about the status of migrant workers?
Yeah, absolutely. The status of having temporary permits or no status is a breeding ground for exploitation. And the UN Rapporteur for Contemporary Forms of Slavery actually called it a breeding ground for slavery and slavery-like conditions. So it's not an exaggeration to call it exploitation. And we're not saying, you know, this happens at every single workplace, or if we're talking about specifically farm workers, we're not saying that all employers are bad. This is not a matter of good employers or bad employers. It's a system of exploitation, right? So that even employers that are following the rules, they're still part of this system of exploitation. For example, farm workers who come up on the program, they don't choose where they get to go. So from when they first arrive in Canada, their choices are stripped away. Their voices are silenced. So you can imagine if you are working somewhere, even if it's a decent workplace, if you don't have the power to speak up about any concerns you have, safety issues, harassment, even from coworkers, if you speak up, and this is why temporary status, having no status, creates exploitation and breeds exploitation, is because migrants are denied the tools to speak up for their rights and protect themselves. Otherwise, because being on a temporary permit, if you speak up, you're facing job termination. Your immigration status is tied to you having a job in Canada. So you're also facing deportation. Many migrant workers depend on their employers for housing, so they're also facing eviction. And for migrant farm workers, they face being blacklisted from the farm work program for life.
I want to talk about that second that last part in a sec, but just to make it like sort of crystal clear for people, let's say a friend of mine or somebody, like let's say somebody is from Honduras and they go back home and they say, hey, you can come work in Canada on Donaldson's farm and it's an apple farm and you get good pay and he treats us well and encourages their friend to come along. There's no guarantee that that friend and the person who sort of encouraged him, gave him the idea, are going to end up in the same place. So, as you could be from a neighborhood of people in one town, and you're all kind of coming to Canada together to work on a farm or whatever business it is. You may all be separated, and then you sort of lose that community, as opposed to trying to find ways that you can keep like social groups together, which also have enormous benefits just in terms of people's like being able to chat with somebody from your hometown is an incredibly different and personal experience as opposed to trying to make a new friend, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another key point of why we're demanding permanent resident status for everybody, is because, they're not only facing family separation when they come to Canada, they're also facing separation from their communities, from their churches back home. You know, these really key areas of support, of encouragement, of upliftment, of places of dignity. Mm-hmm. And they come here and that's all stripped away. Mm-hmm. So that's why the work that we do at Migrant Workers Alliance for Change is membership-based, migrant-led. We create spaces where workers can meet each other, speak openly, speak freely, connect with each other, and really offer each other, you know, that peer support, that feeling of community for whatever they're facing. And a lot of other organizations are offering this as well. Mm-hmm. And these are, you know, migrant created spaces.
Mm-hmm. The other side of this too is that if you're someone who ends up on a blacklist and then you can't come to work in Canada at all, I assume that also comes with like no appeal mechanism, that if you're someone who has legitimate concerns, be they safety concerns or work conditions or living conditions, nobody's stopping to say, why are you on the blacklist? You're just there and gone.
Exactly. And again, this is another example of the complete control that employers have over workers' lives. Even if an employer doesn't like your haircut or the way you looked at him one day or the tone of your voice, or it, for any arbitrary reason, they can report that worker as unsatisfactory and a mark gets put on that worker's name. Mm. And they won't be requested back the following year. And for workers who have come up on the farm program, they are dependent on that employer for requesting them back year after year.
Mm-hmm.
So workers who come up on their first year, it's their governments back home that are sending them to a different farm. And then after that, it's all dependent on the employer. So you can see how their choices are completely stripped away. There's such a lack of control and choice over their own life. And that's why we're calling for permanent status for all.
And what it sounds like, they essentially become people without a country, that if, you know, even if their home country is involved with sort of recruiting them and sending them to Canada, after that first time, it's all on them to sort of stay in the good graces, as it were, and have that ability to come back and keep their job.
Exactly. Or even things like getting sick or being injured on the job. You know, it's such a precarious situation that these workers are in, and they're carrying all that stress with them. So there's a lot of mental health challenges as well that's really impacting their health on a day-to-day basis. And particularly for workers who don't have any status, they also lose their access to healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of workers that are putting off going to the doctor because they can't afford to pay to access that care. So there's just so many issues that stem from their lack of permanent status that Trudeau promised in December of 2021 as part of the mandate letter. And we're still waiting to see that. Mm-hmm. So it's something that can happen overnight. And we're just calling on the government to fulfill their promises.
That mandate letter you mentioned, that's sort of coming right off of COVID, where safety for migrant workers is a concern because, you know, if you're working on a farm, a lot of those people were living communally. And of course, the communal settings were the most dangerous during the height of the pandemic. Were there any kind of lessons learned? Because that seemed like one of those things, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you is that seemed to be one of those things that came and went, that there was like a couple of stories. It's like, you know, this is kind of an issue. And then, you know, we kind of go back to our lives. Like, has there been substantive improvements to worker safety because of the pandemic experience?
Yeah, and I think that's solely due to farm workers organizing and speaking up. So the issues that came out during COVID were nothing new. They were issues that have been there for decades and we're now having a light shone on them and we're being exposed and the public was learning. You know, many of us who live in these rural areas, we know. and we have known for many years. But when COVID hit, a lot of these stories were coming to light and people were getting a glimpse of what the bunkhouses look like, how crowded the conditions are, the kind of abuse and harassment that's happening. And that helped farm workers feel like if we speak out, like people will believe us, you know, people are listening. So more and more migrant farm workers were speaking out. And because of that, it just created pressure for change to happen. So even in the Niger region here, we're seeing employers build new bunk houses. They're being a lot more careful about the language they use towards workers. So things have improved, not because that was the natural progression of things, but because farm workers organized and made it happen.
That was actually going to be one of the things I wanted to follow up with you about was obviously farm workers themselves and migrant workers themselves want to improve their conditions, want to improve how they're able to interact with employers. Obviously, advocates like you do as well. And that's, you know, why you are in business, as it were. But from the side of the bosses, from the side of the managers, do they have a desire to help shepherd the reforms that you want? And are they listening?
I think many do realize that change needs to happen. And it's just, even if you don't care about your employees as human beings, you understand it's just good business sense for your employees to have a safe working environment where they feel like they're part of a team, like we're all working together rather than working against each other. So I think more and more employers are realizing it's in their best interest to provide safe working environments, better housing. You know, if their workers are comfortable, you know, there's going to be less workplace accidents, less tension among their workforce. So, I mean, if there's anyone from the farming community listening to this, again, it's not about good employers versus bad employers. Right. This is all an exploitive system. And it's in all of our best interest to ensure that workers are healthy and safe and have the same access to the same rights, not just on paper, but in reality as well.
Yeah, no, it's one of those rising raising tide raises all ships. I don't know I can't remember the exact wording, but you know what I mean.
Lifting the floor, we all rise, right?
That's right.
Exactly. And we want to see local farms thrive. We don't want to see the loss of more farmland.
Yeah.
Right. I come from a farming family myself. The kids I grew up with, you know, are from farms and they're part of our communities. We want to see our entire communities thrive. And that can't happen as long as migrant workers are denied equal rights.
I think that's an aspect of it that we forget, that in many ways these workers are keeping farming alive, or at least like letting smaller farms thrive. So that, I mean, you know, I'm sure you can go into great detail about how industrial farming has its tremendous drawbacks, and that if there's a market difference between having people in the field tending the crops as opposed to giant shredders and other big farm equipment.
Yeah, it really depends from farm to farm. But, you know, from the smallest farms to the largest corporations, like some of these large greenhouse operations that we see in Leamington, if the worker feels that the employers, the managers, like the management team, is making an effort to recognize them as human, to recognize their dignity, that, you know, no one is asking for 5-star hotels and special treatment. Yeah. You know, they're just asking for the same as everyone else. So this isn't about special rights or anything like that. This is about equal rights.
Right. Keeping an eye on the clock, I don't want to run out of time, but in terms of like what's on the front burner for you and your team right now, like I know that there's this pilot project for care workers that's coming to an end that your group is deeply concerned about. I guess, can you go into a bit of detail about that and you know, any other issues that, you know, that's kind of, you know, eagerly needing your attention at the moment?
Absolutely. So the care worker program is expiring on June 17th. So I'm asking folks who are listening to this to go to our website, migrantworkersallianceforchange.org, and sign the petition so that we can amplify care worker voices and ensure that they're able to maintain their status in Canada. Because otherwise, we're seeing more and more migrant workers losing their status in Canada, becoming undocumented. And this is not a choice that they're making. It's a situation that they're being forced into. Mm-hmm. And likewise, we launched our migrant spring campaign in March. And so to get involved with that, learn more about that, you can head to migrantrights.ca. And there's an email tool that you can use to send a message to the immigration minister, to Trudeau, to cabinet ministers, and to your local MPs. So I encourage everyone to head over there, take action, amplify migrant worker voices. And then we also have, once you sign that, you'll also be invited into the mailing list where there is, you know, crucial analysis, especially as we're coming into election season, anti-migrant racism ramping up. So I encourage everyone to sign that, to share it, and to get involved.
To your point about, I guess, the rhetoric out there, and we were talking about this before we started recording, you know, here in Guelph, we're surrounded by farms. This is, in its way, a farming community. Certainly farmers bring their wares to farmers market, and there's a lot of interaction between the farming community around the city and people in the city who may, you know, certainly buy food if they're not involved in farming themselves. And I guess in terms of, like, raising awareness about the issue locally, if you're somewhere, if you live in Guelph, or you live somewhere like Guelph, or you live in a rural community, as you said, you do see this every day. I guess, how do you encourage people to, you know, raise awareness about these issues? But more than that, just like making sure that migrants and migrant workers in our community feel welcome, that they're not, like, we're not treating them like they're pariahs, that they're stealing jobs and all this other rhetoric, making sure that migrant workers are not just part of their own community, but part of the greater community as well.
Yeah, there's such a wide spectrum on how we can help migrant workers feel included and like an essential part of our communities, like they are, right? Valued community members. So it could be as simple as, you know, if you're driving by a farm and you see workers out in the field honking and waving. Like, it seems like such a tiny thing, but I hear feedback from workers saying, you know, more people are waving at us this year. Like, there's a change. They can feel it. They notice it. They appreciate it. So even if, you know, I know many of us are burned out, we're exhausted. So even if it's something as small as saying hello, waving from a distance, it all adds up. It all matters. It all counts. And for folks who are part of unions or student associations, faith communities, community groups, to really use your collective voice to be amplifying migrant worker demands, and joining in on the Status for All campaign, especially now, is such a crucial time as cabinet members are making decisions about regularization, about permanent status for undocumented people. So get your people together, even if it's like, you know, you and your parents or your grandma, you know, get involved, head over to migrantrights.ca and find a way to plug in. No matter where you are, who you are, how much time, energy you have, there's something you can do.
I do see the bumper stickers around that say, you know, if you live in a city, thank a farmer. I think that could also be extended to thank your local migrant workers as well.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, Kit Andres, just, you know, thank you for all your insights and your information today. I appreciate your time, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so that was, once again, Kit Andres from the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change. And as I was saying, if you're driving through farm country and you see some people working in the fields near the side of the road, give a honk, let them know you care. And my sister still lives down in Wheatley, as we were talking about before the show. But she lived in Leamington while her house was being fixed. She lived in a house in Leamington, literally across the street from a tomato field. So people always used to stop by the side of the road and pick up tomatoes that had fallen off of the plants, and free tomatoes in Leamington all over the freaking place. That's your ketchup. That's your ketchup industry at work.
Tobacco in Tilsonburg, ketchup in Leamington. The Stomping Tom song about every single one of these places. Maybe we'll dig one up.
We should. The CFRU music room, as you know, has extensive archives and lots of vinyl. So
yep.
It's in there somewhere, that's for sure. All right, that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to our show again, you can download it every Monday from our website at opensourcesguelph.com or from the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite app like Apple, TuneIn, and Spotify. We're also on social media. We're on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and we're on Twitter at OS_Guelph. I'll be back here on CFRU Wednesday at 3 p.m. for the movie review show that I co-host called End Credits. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. Or you can check out my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky. And in case of rapture, like, just don't bother contacting me. And if you're joining us at our regular time at 5 o'clock on a Thursday, please stay tuned for the volunteer playlist.
And if I do get raptured up, you can leave a message. I'll be checking them as often as I can. But that's it for this hour. You can hear some more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio coming up. You will hear that show and much, much more as you stay tuned. In the meantime, this show, Open Sources, will be back next Thursday at 5 p.m. for another edition, and we will see you then.